Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Hello, everybody. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today, 16th of February, we will continue listen to Master Tenjin Chosen's previous program, Meditation, Dying, and Karma. And please enjoy.
A couple of weeks ago, I was on a panel of representatives of the various major religions at a discussion in Hamilton. We talked about our views on rebirth, life after death, how to attain world peace, and even what each of us would do if we were Barack Obama. It was an interesting discussion, especially as we had three people talking from God-based religions and me sitting there as a Buddhist, basically refuting the idea of any such all-powerful, overreaching creator. We didn't really have time to discuss it, but I did wonder when the other representatives talked about God, whether they were all talking about the same thing. God seems to me to cover a very wide range of possibilities, including the one that no such thing exists. Certainly a permanent, omnipotent creator God has Buddhists shaking their heads, because something that is permanent and cannot possibly create. Creation means a process of change and relationship. And how can that happen if the creator is permanent? Of course, the Hindu representative spoke of Atman, or the permanent everlasting soul, which Buddha also refuted. He and I had very gentle digs at each other over that. But anyway, this is just a lead into one of our topics today. As those who've been with us for the last few weeks know, we've been talking about the six main afflictive emotions. And so far, we've covered attachment, anger, pride, and ignorance. Still to go are the two, doubt and deluded view. You could say my cogitations about God and his nature are an example of doubt, which is a two-pointed mind about something wavering between one assertion and another. Of course, in Buddhism, doubt about the nature of God is not really a doubt, because we quite categorically say that on the basis of reasoning, a God defined as an omnipotent, independent creator does not exist. In Buddhism, when we talk about doubt, we usually mean doubt about the existence of the Four Noble Truths, the Law of Cause and Effect, the Triple Jewel, and so on. But anyway, before we go on, let's take a look at our motivation for joining the program today. As I've often said before, the best motivation for any action is to gain enlightenment, not only for oneself, but to be of the greatest benefit to the largest number of beings. So let's set such a motivation. If you think that's too great, though, at least motivate that this program becomes a cause for you yourself to attain liberation. Whatever we do, we should avoid the motivation that only seeks happiness in this life, because that's so limited. When this life is over, so is the benefit of the action. Then what will we have to take with us on the rest of our spiritual journey? So let's take a moment to examine our motivation and to set it as high as possible. Thank you. Now, as I said before, when we talk about doubt, we're talking about a wavering mind when we think about the Four Noble Truths, the Triple Gem, the Law of Cause and Effect, and so on. Of course, in the beginning, when we first come across Buddhism, we have to have a certain amount of doubt, because even the Buddha said we mustn't rely on what people tell us. We must test what we hear in the same way as we test gold. If you're going to buy gold, you'll employ every test you can to make sure the yellow metal you're buying is really what you might think it is, and not some foolishness that only looks the part. So we must have a healthy doubt about the teachings, because otherwise, if we just accept it at face value and even follow all the rituals and ceremonies, it won't make a very lasting impression on our minds. When we get into difficult situations, our beliefs will not have much power to help us, because they don't go very deep. In the beginning, we must delve into the teachings and make sure that our faith is based on good reasons and rationality. When we talk about the lack of inherent independent existence of things, for instance, in practice, it's not too difficult to see, even though when we don't think about it, things do appear to have their own independent existence. Albert Einstein famously said about what we experience, "Reality is merely an illusion, albeit a very persistent one." And even in high school physics classes, young people are learning how the macroscopic world we take for granted is based on a microscopic world that is very weird science fiction. As we saw in our meditation last week, if in a thought experiment we progressively deconstruct ourselves, we get a very different picture of ourselves from the one we grasp at in the normal, everyday, non-analytical way of life. So it's not difficult to get at least an intellectual understanding that how we experience reality is not how reality truly exists. We may not know how it exists, but at least we do know our picture is false, which is what the Buddha said 2,500 years ago. With a bit of rational analysis, we can also fairly easily see that the Four Noble Truths are true. We do suffer in various ways. That is obvious to even the stupidest creature. That there is an immediate cause for suffering is also obvious, though the substantial cause, because it depends on the law of karma, is much less obvious. If I stub my toe, I suffer, and the cause of my suffering is not paying enough attention to the way I'm moving or to the environment around me. However, that I'm in the line to suffer a stubbed toe because of a previous negative action, possibly in another life, is not so obvious at all. And that gives rise to a doubt that's not easily explained away. The laws of karma are known as a very hidden phenomena. One of the Buddha's disciples, after lots of meditation, said to the Buddha once that he finally understood karma. The Buddha told him not to say that, because only the Buddha could see all the intricacies of karmic workings. So if that's the case, how do we gain confidence that what the Buddha said about karma is right? In such a situation, we have to look closely at all the Buddha's other teachings and see whether they make sense or not. If all the more obvious teachings, those that are right in front of our face, and those that are only slightly hidden, like the explanations of the nature of reality, if they're all correct, when we examine them closely, we can assume the rest of the teachings are also right. For why would the Buddha lie? If he is the most highly realized being, free from desire, attachment, and so on, he would not have the slightest reason to lie. We only lie if we see some benefit to ourselves. But if we don't even have a concept of I, apart from a mere label, and our sole concern is for others, what purpose would be served by lying? Using such logic, we can come to the conclusion that even when the Buddha was talking about things that in our limited state we can't yet understand, we can accept that what he said was true. For me, the fact that the Buddha described quite precisely the nature of reality, which science is bearing out today, is decisive in deciding that the law of karma is also true. Anyway, things do seem to follow a sequence of cause and effect, even if we can't always see how it works. So going back to the Four Noble Truths, on this logic we can say that the first two, that our existence is in the nature of suffering and there's a cause for it, are true. The third noble truth is that an end to suffering exists. Well, definitely, if you believe in what the Buddha experienced, that is true. But again, one has to examine the facts before making up one's mind. I can't explain what it's like being a Buddha here because I've only a very little intellectual knowledge about it, and also it's very complex. But it is described very extensively in various texts, especially in a sutra called the Tathagatagarbha Sutra. Again, we can't come to a firm belief about it based on our own experience because a Buddha is way beyond anything we can know. But through study and through hearing about the experiences of highly realized masters, we can come to the conclusion that Buddhahood is probably true. Studying the Fourth Noble Truth, the path to the end of suffering, also helps us understand the final state, because it's a graduated path of practice that is mostly easy to understand and grasp intellectually, although the practice might not be as all that easy. Of course, the best way of seeing whether what the Buddha said is true or not is to spend some time practicing his path. Even though we may not be fully convinced, if we get some positive results from meditation practice, it will be an indication of the truth of the path. And if the more we practice, the better the results we obtain, the easier it will be to be convinced. So proper study, contemplation, and meditation leading to positive results will really help rid us of doubt. Now, the main problem of doubt is that it hinders us from making progress along the path we want to follow. Say, for instance, if you want to gain a degree in astronomy. If you go to the lectures, but you have no confidence in the lecturer, and you also think that probably what the textbook says about the planets and stars is wrong, do you think it's possible to make any progress in the degree? It's unlikely you will do the work or pass the exam. That is not to say you should not question the lecturer's assertions and investigate for yourself. But in the end, you will have to develop some confidence in the lecturer and the knowledge he's passing on if you really want to pass the degree. Similarly, we have to develop faith in the Buddha's teachings through a thorough investigation, asking questions, probing, and practicing if we want to progress along the path to enlightenment. That's the way to gradually rid ourselves of doubt. As an initial practice to calm a discursive doubting mind, breathing meditation is very useful. If one's mind is filled with thoughts about whether this is true or that is true, breathing meditation will help calm the questions down, and then we can use concentration to focus objectively on the topic of doubt and reason it through more clearly. Breathing meditation also gives us space to observe and gain some initial understanding how the mind itself works. It gives us a good basis to see, for instance, how things are impermanent, for as we watch the breath and the sensations, we can see that they are always changing. Even just focusing and watching the mind itself, we will see that it also does not stay the same. In this way, we can get some practical experience of the first of the four noble of the four seals, that all compounded phenomena are impermanent. So in this way, we can eliminate the doubt that what the Buddha taught is true. Now that ends the discussion on doubt, and now we go on to the last of the six afflictive emotions, deluded view. Actually, this covers five views altogether, the first being what is rather obscurely called the view of the transitory collection. The transitory collection here refers to the five aggregates and so on that make up a being. They're a collection and they're impermanent or transitory, hence transitory collection. That describes how they exist as an impermanent collection, but it's not how we see ourselves. If I asked you, who are you? How would you appear to yourself to answer the question? Would you say, oh, I'm just a collection of form, feeling, discrimination, karmic formations and consciousness, and so on, just labeled with I? I would sincerely doubt it. When we grasp at this collection, which is merely labeled I, we see a real, independently existing, inherent I, and react to our body and all its parts as though on some level it intrinsically belonged to that I. And so we fall under the compelling spell of I and mine. However, if we look for this I to see how it really exists, surprise, surprise, we won't be able to find it anywhere, except as a mere label on a collection of parts and so on that make us up. This view of I and mine coming through grasping at the transitory collection as if it was something independent and inherently existing is the basis of all other delusions and is the main cause for us to engage in actions that are the source of cyclic existence. Say someone accuses you of something you didn't actually do. What's your immediate reaction? The reaction that arises without thinking. It's an indignant, I didn't do that, isn't it? And if you stop and looked at this strong sense of I that arises, it doesn't appear to depend on anything else, does it? It is as if it stands quite alone and has a very solid appearance. It also appears quite fixed, not changing at all, as though it's always been there like that. In such a situation, we completely lose the sense that we are a phenomena made up of a collection of ever-changing parts, and that I is just a label we put on those parts so we can communicate with each other. No, the I seems to exist inherently, just as the you seems to exist inherently. We seem to be quite distinct entities, not dependent on all the bits and pieces that make us up. And so we can get into quite a distinct fight and give each other quite distinct bloody noses. So there you have it. Through viewing ourselves as distinct, inherently existing and independent eyes, we develop aversion or attachment to each other, which impels us to create actions, which in turn creates the karma that will be the fuel for further experiences in cyclic existence. On and on we go. This is what is meant by the deluded view of the transitory collection. The second of the five views is holding on an extreme view. The Buddha taught the middle way, but when we grasp onto the transitory collection as if it was a permanent, partless, and independent I, we're holding an extreme view, the view of the eternal. It appears to us as though that I is an eternal, unchanging thing. And the Hindu view I spoke of at the beginning of this program, the view that there's a permanent inherent self that goes from life to life, is such a view. So when I go from this life and say I become a donkey, the essence or soul of Tenzin and the essence or soul of the donkey are both the same thing. It doesn't change from life to life, is such an extreme view. The opposite view to this is that the I doesn't really exist at all, and that when I die, that's it. Nothing goes on, it all just dissipates, kind of poof into nothingness. This is the current materialistic view, and from a Buddhist perspective, it is the extreme view of nihilism. The Buddha, of course, taught that a being does go from life to life, but in the sense of a continuum, not in the sense that Tenzin is the same as the donkey. If you ask, is Tenzin completely the same as the donkey, the Buddha would say no. But if you ask, is Tenzin completely different from the donkey, the Buddha would also say no. It's like lighting one candle from another. Is the second flame completely different from the first, or is it completely the same? That indicates the middle way, free from the two extremes. The third view is known as holding false views as supreme. This means that you hold one of the two extreme views as if it was the final highest view. So my Hindu friend, who maintains that ultimately the soul is permanent and partless, and holds that to be the final word on it, holds this false view to be supreme. Similarly, someone like a hardened communist who maintains the highest happiness is material well-being, religion is bunkum, and when you die there's nothing further, holds to a nihilistic view as supreme. These two views are differentiated from the previous two because when you hold to a view as if it was supreme, it's much harder to change your mind. Someone who is born into a religion with an extreme view, for instance, but who doesn't really take much notice of it, has more chance of coming to the correct understanding of reality than someone who becomes a priest and gives their whole life to the same religion. Then the fourth of the five views is holding false ethics and conduct as supreme. In ancient India, and maybe even today, I don't know, some sadhus would light four fires and then sit in the middle of them in the midday sun, believing that this would burn away all their negative karma and lead them to enlightenment. I think it only led them to becoming extremely hot and dehydrated. So basically, this view thinks that indulging in certain meaningless behaviors or holding to equally meaningless ethics will lead to liberation. In our modern-day world, suicide bombers who believe that by detonating explosives strapped to their bodies and so killing a bunch of their enemies will blow themselves into a paradise with 10,000 Vestal Virgins, and they belong to this category of views. Through such deluded actions and beliefs, not only will they not go to a paradise, but they will instead find themselves in a situation of intense suffering for a great length of time in the future. And then the final view is the perverse view that denies the existence of something that actually does exist, or asserts the existence of something that does not exist. For instance, saying that there is no such thing as a law of cause and effect, that things mainly happen by chance, and that suffering does not come from previous negative action, denies something that does exist. And saying that the world is created and controlled by an omnipotent, permanent creator God, asserts something to exist which does not. People who sacrifice animals, maintaining that such sacrifice leads to liberation, not only hold perverse views, but also hold false ethics and conduct as supreme. Sacrificing animals cannot lead to liberation, and holding such views just points a person in the opposite direction from liberation. So now we've looked at the last of the six main afflictive emotions. As I said when we started, we're afflicted by a whole host of delusions, But these are the main ones: attachment, aversion, pride, ignorance, doubt, and deluded views. As the basis of all these afflictive emotions is the view of the transitory collection, let's now do a short meditation on that. Please sit comfortably and concentrate on the breath, allowing the thoughts to come and go without becoming involved in them. Situation in which somebody accused you of something you didn't do. If you haven't had this experience before, imagine what your reaction would be. Let the sense of I arise strongly, and then focus on how it appears to you. Strong and solid this I appears, as though it's a permanent independent thing. Try to find out how this I exists. Is it your body? Is it your mind? Or is it something other than your body and mind? First take your body apart, trying to find this I within the body. Is it your head, your skin, flesh, bones, etc.?
Oh.
I a feeling? Is it a discrimination or an emotion? Is it consciousness? Imagine discarding body and mind. Is there anything left? Just a delusion, a phantom. Now please come out of meditation. You see how difficult it is to pin this I down. It is this false idea of an inherently existing and independent I that is our downfall. Remember, we are just a transitory collection of causes, conditions, and parts that we label I. That is how we exist, and anything else is hallucination. Now we've run out of time. Thank you for joining me today. And please do so again next week. And please dedicate any positive energy from today's program to gaining enlightenment for the benefit of all beings.